Good morning, afternoon, and evening, everyone. On behalf of the AgriLinks team, I'd like to welcome you to the October Ag Sector Council webinar titled The Next Generation of Civil Society Engagement, Boldly Going Where No NGO Has Gone Before. We're excited to have a great lineup of speakers today to discuss the realities of engaging civil society in agricultural development projects. The monthly Ag Sector Council seminar series is a product of the USAID Bureau for Food Security and is implemented by the Knowledge-Driven Agricultural Development Project. My name is Julie McCarty, and I'm a Knowledge Management Specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. I'll be facilitating the webinar today, and so you'll see my name in the chat box and hear my voice during the Q&A session after the presentations. Thank you to everyone so far who has introduced yourself in the chat box, and please continue to do so. It's always really fun to see that we've got a global audience for these webinars. Throughout the webinar, we encourage you to use the chat box to network, to share links and resources, and to ask questions about the presentations at any time. And we'll pose those questions to our speakers in the last section of the webinar today after the presentations when we begin addressing Q&A. And we also have a few speakers on hand or experts on hand to help answer your questions directly in the chat box. Before we get started with the content, I'd like to quickly announce some exciting news on behalf of AgriLinks. We are upgrading the AgriLinks website in November, and so later next month you will see a new platform when you log on to agrilinks.org. We've listened to feedback from ag practitioners and professionals to really completely revamp the website for the better. And the new site will still have blogs, resources, and online trainings brought over from the current version of the site. But we'll also add some all new functionalities to help practitioners connect with each other and learn. The new discussion area that we're featuring, it will be the biggest change and one that we hope you'll quickly take advantage of. Practitioners can use the discussion page to ask questions, discuss challenges, and share ideas. And the site is also more accessible than ever. A mobile version and a low bandwidth option mean that practitioners can easily access AgriLinks resources from the field. So for more information on this, please feel free to contact me or any member of the AgriLinks team using our emails or the agrilinks@agrilinks.org email address. So today we are here to discuss the next generation of civil society engagement. And before we delve into that, our presentation today, I also wanted to briefly call your attention to another AgriLinks event on civil society engagement held last Wednesday as a precursor to today's webinar. We held a one-hour online chat on the AgriLinks website featuring a panel of experts from Chemonix, Catholic Relief Services, and Interaction. And participants asked questions and partook in a very rich discussion about engaging civil society in project design and implementation. So I encourage you to visit the link on this slide, and we'll also post this link in the chat box to view the full discussion. And just to call out three of the key good practices that emerged from that discussion last week, some of the key points. Number one is that definitions for civil society, just how we define it, vary widely depending on customary and legal standards in a given country or other factors. But just setting these parameters on the definition does help prioritize needs and keeps us from slipping into equating giving grants to local NGOs as truly engaging with civil society on systemic changes. Second, capacity building is an important component of engaging civil society, particularly in terms of program design and implementation. It's important not to just pay lip service to building capacity, but to use assessment and other tools to understand the needs of a local organization and build from their strengths. And then thirdly, overall, engaging civil society needs to be purposeful and thoughtfully built into every phase of a project. So we just wanted to share those three takeaways from last week's online Ask Ag discussion. All right, so now let's turn to thinking about the next generation of civil society engagement with Susan Polagrutto, who will be giving an introduction. Susan is a senior democracy advisor for USAID's Bureau for Food Security. And that's her photo up there in the left of the screen. And she is leading the effort to implement the Feed the Future Civil Society Action Plan to strengthen civil society engagement efforts. So I'm going to go ahead and pass the torch over to Susan to take over. So Susan, please unmute your microphone.
Thank you, Julie, for that introduction. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, great. Just checking. Thank you again, Julie, for the introduction, and welcome everybody, and thank you so much for joining us this morning. As many of you may already know, Feed the Future has taken some very important steps in recent years to strengthen how we're engaging civil society. Through the USAID's Advisory Committee on Voluntary Foreign Aid, civil society organizations provided Feed the Future and BFS in particular with recommendations that ultimately provided the basis for the Feed the Future Civil Society Action Plan. That plan was launched in May of 2014, and it outlines some concrete actions that we will take with civil society to continue the fight against hunger and poverty. And some of the things are very, very specific for USAID and our staff, and that includes providing training, it includes providing guidance, it includes providing a best practices handbook that we're currently developing. And all of those activities that we're trying to do, we're ultimately trying to promote country ownership and the effective engagement and meaningful engagement of civil society actors in country. As you already know, civil society partners often implement our programs, but they're doing so much more than that. They're providing us with valuable feedback and input on the priorities and how we design the programs that work. And they get the word out locally and globally on the importance of food security and nutrition issues. So these groups that we're working with in country and even our U.S.-based NGOs are really on the front lines of fighting hunger in their communities, and they're absolutely critical to strengthening food security in sustainable country-driven ways. So today's discussion and webinar, we're highlighting the importance of working with local actors to achieve the Food the Future objectives, as well as how to partner with civil society and agriculture and food security programs and what that looks like. So today you're going to hear some useful approaches and tools for effective engagement, as well as some of the challenges and lessons learned. So with that said, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Winston. So Winston Buahela is responsible for planning and coordinating implementation of all institutional capacity strengthening interventions at relevant government institutions and civil society organizations at both the national and sub-national levels in Tanzania mainland and as well as in Zanzibar. He is a Tanzanian with professional background in corporate law, engaged in development work specifically on capacity enhancement and service improvement for the poor for over 20 years. And through various training and continuous practice, he has amassed skills and experience in participatory management, human resources, organizational development, and he's provided a variety of workshops and seminars and trainings on these issues. So Winston, I will turn it over to you to tell us more about the program in Tanzania and how you're engaging civil society. So Winston, please take it away.
Thank you very much. I hope you all can hear me. As the facilitator has just said, I'm Winston Buahela, working in Feed the Future program in Tanzania for nutrition. And I will be speaking from Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, and together with me, we have Janet Said, who is in Dar es Salaam with me, who will speak later on, and in Washington, we will have another speaker who will also comment later on and maybe participate in text messaging and the chat box. That's Dr. Nene. So in my presentation, I hope you all can see, I will talk through five subtopics. I will introduce the program briefly, very briefly, and then I'll talk through the engagement of our program at national level in terms of the civil society at national level. And then I'll go through and how do we engage with the civil society at district and community level. And then I'll go on trying to talk what are the skills that are recommended for the next generation. And then I'll finish with what are the actual tips for actionable tips for engaging civil society much more effectively. So as I said before, Mwanzobora is a USAID-funded nutrition program under USAID Government Feed the Future Initiative, and its main focus is on the reduction of maternal anemia and childhood stunting. And it envisages to do this by reduction 20%, and it does that by implementation of the evidence-based nutrition SBCC interventions. The program is implemented by a consortium which has four organizations. It is being led by AFRICARE, who is the lead organization, and together with that, there is an organization, nutrition organization called CONSONUT. And CONSONUT is responsible for nutrition technical services. And then we have MANOF, which is responsible for providing in the SBCC communication and programming, and Deloitte with main responsibilities in terms of institutional capacity strengthening. The program covers 33 districts with a population of more than 9.5 million in 8 regions of Tanzania, mainland, and Zanzibar. And its main focus is actually based on the situation in Tanzania as being depicted by the slide which is being displayed right now, because that's actually the situation in terms of the childhood stunting and maternal anemia in Tanzania, and that's the justification of the project activities and interventions. So I'll go directly to the CSO engagement, and I'll start with at national level. At national level, the program engaged with an organization called CONSONUT. CONSONUT is engaged with the program at two fronts. First, it is engaged itself as part of the program consortium member. And at the same time, it is actually a beneficiary for institutional capacity strengthening. So the two sides of this CSO are actually meant to help each other, in the sense that as CONSONUT is implementing and is acting as a technical partner, as a consortium member, it is at the same time enjoying and benefiting from the institutional capacity strengthening, because the skills that are being gained actually have a chance to be implemented live in the program in terms of the activities that are being backstopped technically. So how did the program build CONSONUT capacity? First of all, the program, as part of its capacity strengthening to CONSONUT, there was an institutional and technical capacity assessment that was done, and then capacity gaps were established. And after that, prioritization was done in terms of what are the key areas in terms of the SBCC technical aspect, the governance and financial and grants management. And after those gaps were established and prioritized, CONSONUT was supported in improving and or developing governance, finance, and grant system. And as part of building capacity of this CSO on the side of technical, the CSO was awarded an opportunity to lead the technical implementation of the nutrition SBCC intervention at all levels. And through this engagement, what has CONSONUT benefited actually? And what have we achieved in this time? That through engaging the national CSO, CONSONUT, actually, the program has managed to reach more than 1.7 million women and more than 1.6 children. And these have been reached by nutrition SBCC services. And because of making sure that the services are actually sustainable at the end of the day, one of the means of the program was to make sure that the system was strengthened, the structures and the system that are providing these services. And by doing that, several people within the structures were trained and actually circa 3,500 people were reached in terms of either training or orientation, or at least in terms of awareness. And through the intervention and the engagement with COSNET, COSNET itself has benefited a lot in terms of being part of the consortium, because by being a member of the Mwanzo Bora Program Consortium, its profile have actually been boosted, and the boost of the profile has radiated confidence in organizational competence to handle funds and program. And as a result of that, several donors have entrusted COSNET with funds. And between 2014 and 2018, COSNET is going to be receiving and spending more than $10 million from three different donors that are not USAID. And actually, as part of its benefit, COSNET is also right now using skills, tools, and experience that have been gained through the implementation of the Mwanzo Bora program in other donor-funded program apart from USAID. And of course, without saying that, because of getting more funds to implement other program, COSNET has expanded its staff base, and it has now managed to open sub-offices in the field in order to be able to effectively manage the sub-granted mandate and responsibilities. So that's the engagement at national level. So as I said before, our engagement with CSOs are at national level and at district and community level. So at community level, our engagement with the local, most of them regional or district-based CSO. And how did we procure and engage with the CSO? We did that by making sure that actually we award the existing and the operating CSO. And the awarding, the whole process was based on transparency and competitive process, and that was done by making sure that the institutional assessment is done and the CSO were marked based on their technical competence, and the combination of technical capacity, due diligence, and reference of their capacity, their past performance, actually was the basis for their selection. And over and above that, the experience in implementing and managing grants or program for Africare or other organizations, whether funded by USAID or other entities, also increased their competitiveness. And through this engagement, the program actually managed to provide subgrants to 14 local CSOs, and they are all given contracts to implement evidence-based nutrition SBC interventions. And through this engagement, these local CSOs have managed to reach almost 3 million men and women in more than 2,300 villages in the 20 councils of the program area in the first 4 years. And if you look at the entire process of procurement and awarding, actually the process has exposed CSO to transparency, competition, quality, accountability, timely delivery, and discipline. And after engaging with them, how did you build their capacity? Actually, the CSO were oriented on the program content and working tools, and they were introduced and all linked to the government institutions and structured with the mandate to support program interventions. And they were also introduced to the community and the government-based program service providers. And at the end of the day, they were also introduced to the final beneficiary of the program services. And over and above that, the CSO were supported and were moderated to prepare and plan and budget for the implementation of the community program activities and administration costs. And they were mentored, and awareness session were done together with them to make sure that they oriented the local leaders at the village and hamlet levels, and they oriented the community-based volunteer service providers. And they were also coached and mentored to form community-based beneficiaries, peer support groups, in order to promote peer discussion around recommended nutrition behaviors. And after being given their first orientation and their first initial capacities and introduction to the necessary structures, they were given sub-grants, funds, and opportunity to manage, implement, and spend and report on the funds that have been given to them. And they were alongside, as part of the implementation of the program, they were coached and mentored to effectively coordinate and facilitate peer support groups' behavior changing discussions using providing nutrition as specific kids. They are also coached and mentored to effectively facilitate pharmacy days and demonstration plots to improve availability and accessibility to diverse diets. In the whole process, how did we ensure that there is ownership, sense of belonging, and we enhance the sustainability of the program-supported services? Actually, the sustainability was promoted through mentoring and coaching to position CSO to involve and work within and with the existing government system, institutions, and structures at subnational level. For instance, CSOs were linked and supported to work with the relevant technical personnel at district level and extension workers at ward and village levels. And CSOs were linked also and supported to participate in government planned nutrition intervention at district and community levels. In other words, we encourage CSOs to make sure that their plan and budget are actually reflecting in tandem with what is happening at local government level so that they can marry each other. And over and above that, CSOs were encouraged and supported to be part of the nutrition coordination and decision-making bodies and structure at the district, ward, and village levels. And CSOs were coached and mentored to request information from and provide feedback to normal government database and reporting system. So all the reports that the CSO are providing to the program are actually the very reports that can also be retrieved from the normal government reporting system. Comparatively, through working with the CSO, we have noted several improvements, and one of the improvements is in terms of the quality and quantity of the service delivery through their regular monthly and quarterly reports. And we also noted a comparatively improved performance in their level of interaction with and support to beneficiaries. And that was easily noted through the review reports, on-site mentoring, and during the support supervision visit. So after working with the CSOs at national and subnational level, what are the recommendations in terms of the next generation of CSO on the skills that are needed? So generally, we can say we recommend the skills around basic organization and management skills, and we are referring to things that are related to a normal CSO in terms of the entity choice, what organization legal status that is proper for a CSO, because that's very basic. And skills that are related to proper planning, meaning planning that can actually be implemented, negotiations in the course of they're working, they really need these skills in terms of making sure that they really fit in the normal system they're operating in. Effective supportive supervision skills and things that are related to asset management. And they also need skills around procurement, grants, and financial management, because as they grow, they amass, they collect money, and they receive funds from donors, and they need skills to manage this better so that they can even get more or even manage better the one that they have. They also need skills on resource mobilizations, advocacy, lobbying, and strategic positioning. Sometimes knowing exactly what do they need to say and where do they need to be at what time. It's very important also for them to have skills on self-assessment, starting and managing income-generating activities, especially because most of the CSO that we work with are CSO that do depend on donor money. So sometimes you get a feeling, and actually they admit that if that donor cannot give that money anymore, or if a certain program ends up, they don't know exactly what, how are they going to operate their CSO next time around. So in terms of what are the tips for effective CSO engagement, is that in order to make sure that you have a really effective CSO engagement, make sure you start and build partnership on existing strength and willpower to deliver. This is very important because you cannot start from a clean slate. It has to start from things that are needed to be done. And after that, you have to appreciate the existence of a systemic and administrative or operational capacity gaps and identify, because usually there are a lot of systemic and administrative gaps. So identify those that are relevant or critical gaps that you need to address in order to achieve or to implement what you need to do, and then address those on preference. And sometimes it's good also to mainstream the capacity strengthening initiative, program, activity plan, and budget to make sure that actually theory and practice to come together at the same time, because that's the best way for them to become much more stronger. And always make sure you integrate the planned action within the existing structures and system in order to promote a sense of belonging and a continuity. That means to ensure there is sustainability in what is being done. Thank you. And in Tanzania, Swahili, asante sana.
Great. Thank you so much, Winston, for that presentation. Our next speaker is Adam Keats. Adam is an agricultural economist with over 12 years' experience designing, managing, and monitoring market development initiatives in 18 countries across Asia and Africa. On the USDA Rural Business Sector's Business Services Development Project based in Vietnam, he facilitated entrepreneurial investments in the coconut and rice sectors. With ACD Ivoca, he designed an organizational assessment tool for USAID Food for Peace, and he later served as a regional director for Southeast Asia based in Laos. As the economic team leader for Conservation International based in Cambodia, Adam designed and managed several field projects at the complex nexus of market systems, development, and ecosystem management, including the USAID New Partners in Value Chain Development Project and the Women's Fish Processing Project. Both, that last one is a subcontract under USAID Harvest. Adam is now FinTrack's knowledge manager, and he leads evidence-based learning across a global portfolio of smallholder market development programs. Adam, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Susan. Can everybody hear me okay?
I sure can.
Okay, great. Okay, good morning, everyone. As Susan said, my name is Adam Keats. I'm the Agriculture Knowledge Manager for FinTrack based in our home office here. And I was previously based in Cambodia for several years, where part of that time I spent on producer group development with Cambodia Harvest. So I'm going to be talking about how the Cambodia Harvest Project has been engaging civil society, and I will be specifically focusing on a case study of commercial horticulture producer groups. Okay, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but this is just to give you an overview of the project's objectives and activities. First, Harvest is the Helping Address Rural Vulnerabilities and Ecosystem Stability Program. It's not only a very impressive acronym, it's also a 5.5-year food security program under the U.S. government's Feed the Future and Global Climate Change initiatives. We have an agribusiness component that focuses on horticulture, primarily fresh vegetables. We're also working in the rice value chain as well as the aquaculture value chain. With aquaculture, we're working both in pond and cage systems. We also have the capacity building and social inclusion component, which ensures that we integrate gender, youth, and nutrition sensitivities into everything that we do. We have the natural resource management component, which focuses on climate change mitigation and adaptation, and the enabling environment component, which focuses on engaging with our public sector counterparts, both directly and through technical working groups, to influence policy reform around agriculture, food security, and natural resource management. So as you can see, it's a large, multifaceted project with many moving parts. The project is now in its coming into its final year of implementation, and the impacts that we're seeing in terms of economic, environmental, and nutritional gains are really quite substantial. So first, Susan gave a bit of a primer on this as we started, but just to provide a bit of a bigger picture view of what we're talking about when we talk about civil society, I do think that there's a wide perception out there that civil society refers almost exclusively to NGOs and interest groups, particularly those engaging in political advocacy. And while those types of organizations are certainly a very important component of the broader sector, I think it's important to draw attention to the diverse nature of this sector, and which is why this is a really valuable discussion we're having today, thanks to USAID and AgriLinks. So some keywords that I'd like to draw attention to from USAID's CSO Sustainability Index are informal, self-governing, free choice. As you'll see in the slides that follow, these are a few characteristics that we talk about specific to how we strengthen horticulture producer groups in Cambodia. First, I'd like to set the stage with a brief discussion about the local context in Cambodia, because in so many ways, context really does matter, particularly in terms of how local realities influence the design and implementation of activities engaging with and supporting the civil society sector. First, the enabling environment, particularly the legal and regulatory framework under which the civil society sector operates is important. There has been progress as well as challenges, but generally the civil society sector in Cambodia is less established, less mature than in other regions, particularly in Latin America, for instance, which in many ways does have a relatively vibrant civil society sector. So the public sector in Cambodia and more generally in Southeast Asia does increasingly recognize the role of non-governmental actors. However, there continues to be what I call here a reluctant acceptance and at times more active restraint of the civil society sector through formal laws and regulations. And that's particularly acute in the political and environmental space. I think it's also important to recognize how history influences the dynamics of the sector. In Cambodia, the legacy of the Khmer Rouge continues to influence many informal norms in terms of the way in which citizens interact, cooperate, and compete. Generally, there's still a distrust of those outside the nucleus family, and there continues to be skepticism of collective production activities. Particularly the term, quote, cooperative, is often viewed with concern. And in many ways, this extends to Vietnam and Laos as well, where they had similar recent histories of forced labor. So what is clear from the CSO Sustainability Index definition is that civil society encompasses a broad range of local organizations. Similarly, Harvest, the Cambodia Harvest Program, is working across a very diverse group of civil society subtypes, we could call them. This engagement ranges from our partnerships with local NGOs who are project implementers. In these arrangements, we strengthen their technical capacity to deliver services to farming communities, and the program benefits from those local NGOs in terms of their grassroots knowledge and expertise within communities. Our engagement also spans the strengthening of community-based organizations to manage common pool resources like fisheries, water, and forestry, also including building self-help groups like women's savings groups, and of course to more explicit production-oriented groups in aquaculture, rice, non-timber forest products, and horticulture that we'll discuss here in more detail. So across 11 different subtypes of the civil society sector, we're working with and through nearly 450 CSOs. But for this presentation, we're just going to drill down specifically on how we strengthen those commercial horticulture groups and some lessons learned from those experiences. Okay, so let's get into specifically how the project supports the development of the of those producer groups. What do they look like on the ground, and what do they do? Well, in terms of scope, their function is simply the production and marketing of horticulture products. So each of the members share this targeted commercial interest. In terms of form, on average, each group has about 12 members. They're organized at the village level with members in close geographic proximity to one another. This allows them to aggregate their harvests as well as to aggregate their demand for inputs. And this aggregation is what attracts buyers and suppliers and effectively reduces the transaction costs of doing business with small farmers. In terms of leadership of the groups, there is limited hierarchy with only a president, vice president, and marketing representative elected by the rest of the members. And finally, just to give you a sense of the scale that the project has been working on, we have organized 73 of these groups representing 870 farmers to date, and group horticulture marketing to date has resulted in about $1.1 million of incremental sales, of new sales, and that represents about 3,500 metric tons of horticulture produce. And now, how do these groups operate? It's important to point out, as we'll discuss a bit in the lessons learned slide, that not every group operates the same. They're really quite flexible in terms of the activities that they choose to undertake and how they carry out their work. But generally, their activities are centered around input market access, financial market access, and output market access. For input market access, the project facilitates field days with input providers to demonstrate their products, raise awareness, and build loyalty among farmer group members. For the most part, farmers in Cambodia already know their input providers, but these activities solidify those relationships. And so some groups may also pool their resources to bulk buy inputs like plastic covering, seedling trays, etc., like we see in this picture here of a group that did that to bring down their unit costs. For financial market access, there are some groups, again, not all, who may enter into borrowing agreements with local MFIs where the group guarantees a loan for one member, and upon repayment, the next member is afforded the opportunity to borrow. Given the shared risk involved in these types of arrangements, it's natural to see why not all groups pursue this course. However, when it does work, it can be a very effective way for farmers with limited collateral to access working capital loans. And for output market access, the marketing representative of the group conveys to members the target crops of local buyers and the market window for supplying it at where peak demand exists. Also, the marketing representative may organize physical logistics with the buyer to minimize crop losses. This may include either the coordination of a central collection point within the village or scheduling buyer pickups at individual plots around harvest times. So with those functions in mind, it's important to consider what skills these farmer groups need to succeed. First and foremost, they need to understand the market. They need to know what those market windows are and the quality specifications for their target crops and how to program their planting to meet those demands. And that's what we call calendarized production. Next, they need to know how to apply good agricultural practices and modern technologies so that they can meet those expectations and those market specifications. The gaps we teach, good agricultural practices we teach include things such as land preparation, including raised beds, also seedling transplantation, integrated pest management, of course, which is inclusive of crop rotation, soil nutrient management, water resource management, and some technologies that we transfer include things from as simple as plastic mulch and trellis twine to hybrid seeds, inorganic fertilizers, crop protection products, and drip irrigation systems. And finally, in terms of what they need to succeed, farm administration, or simply record keeping. As important as it is, most smallholder farmers simply don't do it. It helps them track income and expenses. It allows them to show financial institutions what their past returns are and opportunities are for future returns, which makes them more bankable. And it allows them to make investment decisions to improve the operations of their farm. Okay, now here I'd like to provide an overview of the level of support that the project provides. So specifically, as external facilitators, what role does the Cambodia Harvest Project and our local partners play in establishing and supporting these groups? The first is target area selection, based on several pre-established criteria, including horticulture potential, which is inclusive, obviously, of agroecological characteristics, market access, etc. And we also consider development impact objectives, inclusive of health and nutrition status of villages and other demographics such as women and youth populations engaged or not engaged in agriculture in those areas. We then work through the commune and the village heads to identify farmers that are interested in horticulture group participation. Those who are interested and committed self-select into the group. However, within that self-selection process, as facilitators, we very clearly promote these opportunities to women and youth. And for the leadership of each group, we develop a short list of candidates based on several criteria. This includes who is respected and trusted in the village, their willingness and ability to transfer the knowledge that they gain to other members and other village members who are not in the groups, of course. And we consider social inclusion. So this process of shortlisting leadership candidates allows us as facilitators to further promote women and youth, not only in membership positions, but in leadership positions within the groups. And then the project supports these producer groups for a period of 18 months. And this represents about 4 to 5 production cycles. This is assuming 2 to 3 production cycles per year. Just as an aside, the number of production cycles depends on their year-round water availability and their ability to harness that water that they do have. So currently about 45% of all group members now do have access to irrigation and can produce year-round. And the specific support that the project provides includes cost shares for inputs initially to jumpstart the lead farmer demonstration sites on which knowledge transfer on-farm extension visits take place. The project also provides access to weekly market-driven on-farm extension visits, as well as I mentioned earlier, monthly field days between input providers and farmers. And we also facilitate initial linkages with key buyers in the area where those relationships do not currently exist. Okay, so after 18 months of initial support, the producer group graduates from project support, and at this point, they're equipped with the knowledge to stand on their own. Out of the 73 horticulture producer groups that we've established, we found that more than 50 are still operating as a group. It's natural and should be expected that not all groups will continue in perpetuity. But for those who are not currently operating as groups, those individual farmers now have the technical skills that they need to succeed in the market that they didn't previously have. But for one reason or another, they chose to operate as individual farmers, and that's okay. Nonetheless, we see that this 70% of groups continuing to operate collectively is a testament to the value that these types of CSOs can provide in terms of access to on-farm knowledge and market access. Some of the factors that we believe contributes to the sustained operations of those groups are listed here. Market-driven. These groups are market-driven and organized around a very discrete shared commercial interest. Self-selection. Members choose to join a group or to not join a group. They are not co-opted into this process. The groups are unburdened. They're unburdened by external operational demands, and therefore they have very little to no overhead costs. And they're flexible. As I mentioned before, group dynamics vary from group to group, and each one operates a bit differently. Some may bulk buy inputs, and some may not. Some may organize central collection points for buyers. Some may prefer individual pickups at their farm gate. Whatever works for them. And some of these seemingly simple collective activities involve a great deal of trust and logistical skills. So while some groups are collectively organizing their planting decisions based on buyer demands, for instance, they may also prefer to transact as individuals, and that's okay. That flexibility may be one factor that keeps the majority of these groups operating on their own without project support. And one more thing that we think contributes to the sustainability of these activities. Once farmers experience the tangible value of collective action, they tend to continue it. But if there are problems of free riders or cheating within the group or just limited added value compared to what farmers can achieve as individuals, then the group's ability to be sustained becomes more difficult. Okay, this is my last slide, and it is just a few takeaways that we think are relevant in Cambodia and beyond. First, the civil society sector is diverse, as we've already mentioned, and all forms of CSOs are needed. No single model is a silver bullet for all of the challenges and all of the contexts that we may see, but it's important that we recognize informal producer groups as a part of that robust civil society sector that we're all seeking. There's often a lot of focus put on the group or the organization itself. In the case of the informal producer groups, the group itself was not the goal for the project. The group is seen as an important vehicle for knowledge transfer and market access. It's the producer capacity to achieve a critical mass of supply and demand that enables them to increase their incomes, that's ultimately the goal. And a last word on the skills that external facilitators need. In order to gain trust from farmers, to build trust within a producer group, and to foster trust between farmers and market actors, we as external facilitators really must bring, first and foremost, extensive, practical, technical, market-driven agronomic knowledge to the table. Both farmers and market actors must first trust us and our local partners, of course, in that facilitator role. They need to know that we know what we're talking about, and we can do that by working alongside them to demonstrate success initially. And of course, we must also have a comprehensive understanding of the local context and the ability to ensure inclusion and gains among women, youth, and other marginalized individuals within the village. So that's it for me. Thank you very much, and I look forward to answering any questions you may have.
Great. Thank you so much, Adam, for that very thorough presentation. We sincerely appreciate it. Janice. Janice is a nutrition advisor and public health specialist for USAID with extensive experience of more than 10 years in a variety of capacities. Currently, she is serving as a champion for health, agriculture, and nutrition linkages while coordinating cross-sector nutrition activities in Tanzania. In addition, Janice manages Missions Global Health and Feed the Future activities in improving nutrition status among women and children under 5. Prior to joining USAID, she worked with refugees in camps with hands-on programs that addressed severe and acute undernutrition among women and children in those refugee camps. Janice, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I hope you can hear me. So straight to the point, from USAID standpoint, particularly in relation to nutrition, the agenda of engaging civil society is a work in progress. And this is because the reasons that triggered USAID Tanzania to engage civil societies are still valid. There is high levels of undernutrition, particularly stunting, of which is a kind of hidden problem from the eyes of the community. So engagement of civil societies here was very, very important for us. And also, I've just seen a lot of programs come and go without leaving a trace. So USAID Tanzania wanted to try make these efforts more sustainable by engaging the community. And if you can recall what Winston has presented, for example, we kind of having an ambitious goals. And so in order to achieve that, we needed a broad-based kind of target group to reach where women and children are living. And so civil societies that lives in the same community, we thought was going to be important for us. The question of how has not been straightforward even for us, because for example, we have just learned that engaging civil societies in implementation at the same time building their capacity is not easy, especially if a donor or implementing partner is pushing for the quick results. And so to get out of that, it's very, very important that during the designing of a program, it's better to build in adequate time that will allow the CSO to deliver on the project, but at the same time growing in terms of the capacity. And also think about building in a transparency that will help the CSOs to understand how to negotiate with the funders, how to effectively implement projects. Again, you need to build in a good relationship between the implementers and and civil societies. This is because sometimes this can be achieved by creating environment that attracts trust between the implementing partner and the civil societies. I'm just putting this forward because we have had a case in which civil societies feel like they are left out of the consortium, or they are left out, they are not considered to be the same partner who can deliver on their mandates. So I think it's very, very important to create the environment of which they can feel comfortable and be able to share what they feel and to feel as part of the project. Another important thing is to have a consultative procurement process. So if I can use an example of USAID Tanzania, when we are developing these big programs, we had to go out considering different stakeholders in their respective groups, civil societies, private sector, local governments, and so forth. And the question was, to ask them, how can they benefit from these projects? We knew it wasn't everybody who was going to be part of the consortium, but we wanted to get the input on what they value, on what they think can be helpful for them. And so we got the input and we incorporated those inputs, and really they helped us. When we are offering the issuing the request for proposal for application, I think that gave courage to CSOs to try, and we got a lot of application, and we can see the results through the projects that we are implementing right now. So from the experience, we now know that effective engagement of civil societies have to be accompanied with capacity building. I know one of the presenters has mentioned this. And this capacity building will depend on the need. I could be focusing on things like resource mobilization, financial management, human resource development, knowledge management, governance, organizational structure, and so forth. This will be unique to each civil society, and that will come after the assessment is done. So if capacity building can be done in a good faith, it can result in a strong, productive relationship between CSOs and implementing partners, and they can also build in the confidence that they can do business properly. Over to you.